listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
You know, these days, finding a psychiatrist who has time to actually talk with you is really rare. But finding a psychiatrist who will tell you anything about him or her own self or his or her own life, that's even more rare. But how about finding a psychiatrist right now, today, who tells you a lot about the things he's needed to learn in life, the mistakes he's made, and the ways he's able to change himself and his life? And how about also being able to talk with him directly, which you can do today right here on Full Power Living as I talk with Brooklyn-born psychiatrist Dr. Johnny Lopps about how you can reinvent yourself. So our toll-free number is 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. Well, welcome to Full Power Living. We're helping the world to realize the power and importance of human emotion and what wonderful things happen when we become masters of our emotions. You can listen on Blog Talk Radio or emotionalpro.com, and we have a chat on each of those locations. So please feel free to ask your questions or make your comments. So my guest is Dr. Johnny Lopps. He's a board-certified adult, child, and adolescent psychiatrist in Williamsburg, New York, known as being a therapist's psychiatrist. He's a clinical instructor of psychiatry for the Maimonides Medical Center Psychiatry Residency Program. Let me slow down a minute. And an assistant professor of psychiatry at the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine. He works with a diverse practice that includes athletes, artists, and underprivileged youth. He also was a team psychiatrist for the Brooklyn Nets. And in addition to his psychiatric work, and we'll talk about this some, Dr. Lopps has been a professional actor for over 15 years and has appeared in numerous stage and film productions in New York City especially. You can find him on the web at drjohnnylopps.com, Dr. Johnny, J-O-H-N-N-Y, Lopps.com. So, Dr. Johnny Lopps, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
All right. Well, I think most of us tend to stand in awe and therefore at a distance from people who know about parts of life that are powerful and mysterious for us, like psychiatrists. I've interviewed Dr. Peter Bregan, who's a wonderful psychiatrist. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
And he's quite warm and human, but most psychiatrists don't tell us a lot about their personal struggles and hang-ups.
Sure.
And I want to know what led you to write a book to help others by telling them a great deal about your deeply personal experiences and what you've done to heal them. What led you to do that?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think the first stems from, I think we're at a time in our country right now that is becoming a little bit of a disconnect from people who aren't born in privilege, that they no longer believe in the possibilities that they could obtain success in this world, that there is becoming this sort of line placed in the sand that puts, you know, everyone talks about the one percenters on one side of the line and everybody else on the other. And I find when I was working with a lot of youth and people in their late teens, early 20s, as I was growing into a psychiatrist, there sort of just seems to be this anxiety, this new anxiety, especially because of the utilization of the internet, that they no longer are believing in the potentiality within themselves, that they're sort of stuck to the situations and scenarios that they grew up in. And I kind of was starting to get saddened by that reality. A lot of folks are not believing in the possibilities that one can pull themselves up by the bootstraps regardless of the various traumas and negative experiences they had as children and young adults, and that if they really just slow down, make baby steps and towards certain skills and tools that are needed to gain success, they can do that. And I wanted to show them that it's possible as a psychiatrist who did not grow up in privilege. My parents both didn't graduate high school. I don't think my parents, I always joke, they didn't know what the SAT was the day I went and took the SAT.
Wow.
And I was very behind the eight ball, very, very behind the eight ball, more than most people I come across, even more than my patients that I come across. And yet I made a ton of sacrifices. I made a ton of mistakes. But I, as my the 11 chapters in my book are the 11 things that I did time and time again that I became mindful of through failure, through mistakes, through mentorship that I struggled with, and I realized they had to be worked on. Otherwise, I wasn't going to be able to move up the ladder as I, you know, not everyone wants to or has to, but I wanted to. So I shared my story.
Yeah. Well, and I must say, I just for you guys who are listening, that you, Dr. Lopsit, were able to star in plays in New York City at the same time you were going through medical school and residency. That's like unheard of.
I think it's one of the worst in all time, apparently. It's a pretty wacky experience, but that would be one of my chapters about time management and executive functioning skills. I think I'm not the brightest guy in the world. In fact, I didn't even do that great on my SAT. But I was able to become an expert in time management and executive functioning skills that I was able to get all my medical work done through the day so that I would be able to leave the hospital, go to the city, rehearse for 3 hours, come home, run my lines, and wake up and go right back to the hospital. But people don't realize that another reason why I'm struggling with a lot of young folks in their 20s today is they don't want to leave their social life for 3 months at a time. I didn't see friends. I didn't get to go to parties. My want at that moment was to be a good physician during the day and be in this play. And to do that, I had to 24/7 for 3 to 4 months at a time live those two parts of my life, ignoring a lot of other parts that, yes, can bring me pleasure, but weren't going to lead to the success I was looking for at those moments.
So I don't remember reading it specifically in your book, but what I hear you talking about is the power of making decisions also and having intention about what you're doing. I don't recall you saying it that way. I know you did talk about it. But that sounds like a really, like, this is what I want to do, this is my intention, and here's my decision to be able to do it.
Right. And you know, I wouldn't say I can take any medical student or resident and turn them into a professional actor at night. But that started 15 years prior when I was in college and said, the two things I enjoy in this world are medicine and acting. So very similarly, I took my biochemistry classes during the day and I took my theater classes and started rehearsing and performing at night, knowing that maybe 15 years from now, I will be able to do both. So I had two goals and I broke them down into small steps and said, now that I'm in college where I'm not being asked to make money, I'm not being asked to raise a family, let me continue to work on the tools and skills needed to excel at these two domains so that if the time comes up, I'd be able to utilize those tools to do both. And fortunately, I was able to do that.
Well, now, I mean, to me, that's amazing. I happen to be married to a retired doctor, and when he talks to me about his training, I wasn't around then. I've only been around him about the last 20 years. It just sounded like it was totally overwhelming experience, and so I have to say from what I've learned about it that I'm just incredibly impressed that you used your executive functioning skills that you talk about in your book in order to set that up. Now, there's a lot of things, you talk about a lot of things that you overcame, but your early life you describe as an obsessive, anxiety-ridden childhood, complete with 12-year-old neighborhood tough guys. You had disastrous early dating experience, and when you were 23, you even had your nose broken by somebody that you were taunting on the basketball court, if I recall that correctly. So, you know, not a lot of people say, well, listen, I had these terrible experiences in my childhood, and therefore I'm going to be scarred and can't overcome them. I believe that those situations are set up so that we can overcome them, and you apparently do too.
Mm-hmm. So if there's nobody that meets me in person that believes my stories. It's not, and they don't, it's not that they don't believe them, but they're joking. How is this possible? I would pass you on the street and never think that. And there's your answer, because I've reinvented myself. Mm-hmm. So the bread is in the pudding when you meet me and say, I just don't see you fighting 12 years ago. Right, because I don't act that way anymore. So one of the ideals is that though I experience those various traumas and mental health issues, I continue to work hard, ask a lot of questions, continue to get support, and try to have the insight to make better decisions. It goes back to exactly what you said. I mean, because we all have to make, we make thousands of decisions a day, but which decisions can you not be impulsive that would be more in the risky situation, and what decisions continue to guide you towards the ideal many years later? I think when we're speaking, because it sounds like we're speaking along the lines still in the realm of executive functioning skills and overcoming stress, it's about frustration tolerance. A lot of people today, they would look at me in two heads if I said, listen, today we're going to start working on skills that I hope in 15 years you're going to be able to overcome. People want results today.
Uh-huh.
They want this to hopefully be gone in a year. But everything that's in my book took almost over 10 years. And I was determined. I was resilient. I had a lot of ups and downs. I had a lot of sadnesses. I realized still in my mid-20s, I was very behind my peers in terms of learning how to date and work on social skills in that realm. But I continue to hang out with friends and get mentorship and ask questions and put myself out there. And over time, I was able to get my own special relationships. But people give up way too easily. People don't want to persevere. And in a way, as I'm working with more higher-end clients, I'm finding that their children are actually more behind the eight ball than I was in a way. It's crazy to say, even though when I went through those traumas, they were very painful and I would never want to relive them again. But I really think because I had such an optimistic style, they gave me the resilience that as I got older, many things don't cause me distress anymore because I've seen so many negative experiences. But folks who are sheltered and don't experience them or have helicopter parents or whatnot, they become a young 20 person and they just don't have the wherewithal to manage stressors and conflicts, and they really are really behind in terms of, so in a way, almost experiencing some traumas as a youth, not to say it has to be the ones I do, but I'm a big advocate that, you know, we have to learn resilience as a young person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've really been, I told you before the show that my husband is ill with cancer, and he's retired neurosurgeon, and he put a lot of work into becoming a doctor and running his practice and so forth for 45 years.
Mm.
And as he has moved away from that particular thing in his life, we've been able to see some of the patterns. His mother did so many things for him as he was growing up that he pretty much feels lost in the everyday world. And I've really been looking at that with other people. And since I'm interested in parenting, you know, looking at the fact that we really need to teach our children to be resilient and to solve their own problems, because otherwise it literally goes on for a lifetime that you don't feel equal to the task of living your own life.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's sort of a little bit of a touchy situation, but it's no surprise that even some of our most quote-unquote successful people, our top doctors, our top lawyers, our top politicians, they stink at life.
Mm-hmm.
I just wrote an article last week that said how having wealth and fame doesn't mean you are quote-unquote successful, because a lot of folks immerse themselves in a skill that they're really good at, and because they are good at it, and everything else in life, they're not so good at it, and those careers allow you to almost obsess yourself with that work, that they struggle with managing emotions and dealing with children, dealing with friendships, dealing with their partners. A lot of folks find themselves isolated or lonely. I tell a great story to a lot of my patients that are actually working on this right now about how I have a good friend whose father is a scientist, and I saw him 2 months ago, and he told a great story about he went to Shanghai for a conference, for a scientific conference, and out of the elevator came his mentor from the 70s, who now has to be in his mid-90s. And he said he had to be there for the conference. He didn't want to bother him because he looked like he was just getting off the plane. Long story short, he gets to the conference, sees him, walks up to him, reintroduces himself. Of course, the mentor says, "Of course I remember you." And my friend's father was like, "What the heck are you doing here? You're in your 90s. You're in Shanghai." And I really appreciate that the gentleman was honest to my friend's father and said, "Listen, all I did was work my whole life. And, you know, I don't have a good relationship with my wife. I don't have a good relationship with my kids. I don't have many friends. And so the only thing I do these days is fly around to these conferences trying to still remain significant."
Oh, wow.
And that to me is heartbreaking.
It is. It is.
And that's just, you know, I think people allow glory from work and success, and I think it's becoming harder because of the internet and celebrity life, that this is exactly the root of what my book is about, is that we have to go back to the simpleness of life, that you work a little bit at your job, a little bit with friendships, a little bit with your peers, and it's about the overall aspect, not what you think you want to share on Facebook or Twitter, hoping to get those likes and people to admire you. Because a lot of those people that work really hard to do that, once they click the button on Facebook, they're probably alone again or not having as many friends in real life to integrate and share those successes with.
So what I'm really aware of as you're talking is how easy it is to do the thing that you're talking about, to focus on either a distraction or a Facebook or a career or a specialty in something and thereby not develop your full self. And so there's a curiosity in me. You grew up in Brooklyn, which is very, very much an in the present, in the world kind of experience. What effect did growing up in Brooklyn have on your emphasis of making sure that you partake in many different parts of life?
I think the absence of them. You know, I grew up in a very blue-collar neighborhood of Brooklyn where it was pretty much we spent our time playing sports, but when we played sports, it was very aggressive, it was very violent. Most of the kids that I played basketball with were doing drugs, selling drugs, would be gone for a year or two because of possession or even possession of guns. And I just felt that even though there was no such thing as the internet in the mid-80s, I felt there was more to life than these experiences that I was being exposed to. And even though my parents weren't the most worldly people, I think my dad he was a Marine, and I think he's seen a little bit of the world and got knocked down a lot, that he shared with me that if you worked hard, and though I can't give it to you, if you get an education, many doors will open up to you that you'd be surprised and very excited about. so I think I really took on that because what I was seeing just didn't make sense of what I wanted out of life. And though my father is a great man and he's very kind to me and he's tried to give his best to me, unfortunately there was still a lot of experiences that he couldn't accentuate for me. He couldn't help me with my social skills. He couldn't help me work through my emotional traumas because he had his own emotional traumas to deal with. So even though I got the education and my college years were growing and nurturing the academics, I was still lagging behind in the other intelligences, social and emotional intelligence, and that required my own responsibility and my own navigation to master those so I could be successful as an adult with friendships and relationships.
Now, there's something you're bringing up here that certainly I've run into a lot. I've been a psychotherapist. I'm a clinical social worker for the last 43 years. And that is that so many therapists have horrendous experiences in their childhoods, or challenging experiences, whatever. Some people say that therapists are more screwed up than others, and for example. So what I have noticed, and it's a lot of what you're telling us and what you say in your book too, is that in essence it's because we face these issues and we want to overcome them. That's what leads us into wanting to help other people with challenges that they have. Is that true for you?
I look at it as a puzzle. I think I agree with you that, even by saying I look at it as a puzzle, I'm looking at the puzzle of how I came to be me. And I think my book is sort of decoding the puzzle. It's sort of decoding who I was the first 36 years of my life, because I do say that publishing the book is the conclusion of chapter one of my life. It's day one to year 36. And now as I move into 37, I say that I'm able to walk away from those experiences knowing that I fully have reinvented myself. So I think I was always interested about, well, how come going to college I was so behind the eight ball with other folks in terms of social skills? Why were so many other kids easier at 18 to navigate dating and being able to balance studying and going out at night and having some fun? Why was that such a struggle for me? And I think as I've persevered in my education, I've really enjoyed becoming an expert in mental health and mostly development. That's where I take pride in my child psychiatry training, to ascertain the developmental deficits, whether it's absent parenting, child, single mother, single parent, or the opposite, the helicopter parents, that there's so many different ways to look at our experiences. There's always two sides of the coin, that it can shape a unique person to struggle with one of the various intelligences, that it's now up to the clinician as that person comes to our office to help mature and nurture that deficit so that that person can catch up and now have the tools to reintegrate in life and be more successful.
I really like the way you say that. That's the way I've looked at the work that I do too. It's like, you know, there's usually not something wrong with somebody. It's that there are places where they didn't learn, and when they get the tools and they know what they need to do, most people can fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're talking about in Reinvent Yourself also.
Correct. And also because I'm a psychiatrist, I wanted to take the opportunity to, you know, again, reintegrate even our specialty and sort of share with the world that I think in 2015, I do think psychiatrists the last 20 years spent way too much time focusing on psychopharmacology. And I agree, and of course I give a lot of medication in my office because the person's deficits are so impactful that in the accumulation of stressors, they've developed these biological symptoms and I need to decrease them. But once that's done, you can't just say you're done with the medication, good luck to you. The better psychiatrist will understand, well, what were the deficits that were the risk factor to when this person got stressed? They then developed the anxiety disorder, the depressive disorder, even the mania and the psychosis. And so we have to go a step further, and even if we utilize medication, we have to have a better understanding of the core from a developmental point of view about why that person's at risk to begin with.
And what I like there is that what you're really talking about is you want to get to the base cause and help the person to really heal. You don't want to just relieve symptoms, and that, as we know, is a common concern with modern medicine and psychiatry.
Right.
So thank you for doing that.
And insurance companies, let's be honest. You know, they're the ones that are not allowing insurance-based psychiatrists to even have enough time to ask the questions. So it's we're in a tough situation today.
Yeah. Well, we're up to our first break. So let me ask you who are listening, would you rather relate to someone who's nice or someone who's kind? Dr. Johnny Lopes will talk with us about what nice people actually do for you and what the difference between nice and kind is when you're on the receiving end. We'll do that when we return right here on Full Power Living.
I Eileen Dillon is a certified senior life mentor with Accessing Universal Intelligence. She's available to conduct mentoring sessions with you to help you understand, change, and evolve using the advice of your own higher self. You can be anywhere in the world. Sessions are conducted through Skype. For more information about these life mentoring sessions, fees, and how to register, go to www.emotionalpro.com and click on the mentoring link at the top. Get personally tailored assistance with your toughest life questions. Visit mentoring@emotionalpro.com today.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week on Full Power Living, I'm talking with Uma Girish about life, love, and life's losses. She's the author of a memoir entitled Losing Amma, Finding Home. That's next Thursday, July 23rd at 9 a.m. Pacific time or noon Eastern. And I'll be talking with Uma about living through pain and transforming it as she discovered her true calling and her life's purpose. I also invite you to register at emotionalpro.com to receive our weekly newsletter. We'll keep you up to date on the shows and topics we have for you here on Full Power Living. And while you're there, you can also click on the CCFL Global Academy logo on the landing page so you can find out firsthand about the services and information that's available for you, your children, and your family through the Academy. For less than a dollar a day, you can. There's a wide range of information and help for you and your children. And I am involved in this membership program as the expert on emotional mastery and ending codependence. So I'd love to see you on the Global Academy. That's click on it on emotionalpro.com. Well, my guest today is Dr. Johnny Lopes. He's born in Brooklyn, and he's now a respected Williamsburg psychiatrist. And we've been talking about the various chapters in your book, Dr. Lopes. Mm-hmm. You've been in those chapters, you talk about things that we need to do differently in order to live more effective lives. And I want to talk about some of those things. I made a list of them here. Negative thinking, how we use language with ourselves and others, the importance of filling our own selves up instead of looking to others for validation, and so forth. So talk to me about some of these things. How did you find them important? What was important about them as you were reinventing yourself?
I think they were a combination of my own experiences and projecting them onto my patients as I grew into my psychiatric experience. I think enough time, you see enough patients that come to your office and they're starting to tell you about how, this happened and I just thought it was going to go this way, but it wasn't, or that happened, I got so angry so quickly. And this guy cut me off, and I automatically assumed he was a jerk. Or my teacher didn't call on me, and I now didn't hate my. I thought my teacher didn't like me, and I just started realizing that, wow, how many folks come to see me that consistently. One of the reasons it seems like why they're always so anxious or emotional or irritable is that their brain is so quick to assume the worst in every situation, and yet it's fascinating that there's never a moment that they stop themselves and say, what about the opposite of how my brain feels? I think a lot of people, unfortunately, walk around this planet just believing everything that comes to their brain because it comes to their brain, that simply. And you can understand why that is the hallmark of everything in our world. That's the hallmark of politics. That's the hallmark of our news. That's the hallmark of gossip. And if, you know, you and I are both mental health clinicians, we know it's all kind of, you know, it's all a little bit of BS.
Right.
But yet most people go around having these negative experiences and these negative emotions, and they allow it to be. And so, you know, thinking a lot as I especially grew to be a CBT therapist, you start recognizing that, gosh darn it, if a lot of people can at least just take a step back and start getting better at challenging their automatic thoughts and being able to suppress them quickly as they come to their forebrain, because that's going to be the natural inclination, then maybe their day won't be so hostile. They won't be carrying that negativity through the course of the day. I mean, if you're on the highway at 7 o'clock in the morning going to a busy day at the office and someone cuts you off, and you sort of get agitated, and that guy's a jerk, and you can feel your heart beating, and you're starting to breathe faster. Maybe there's a part of you that even presses on the accelerator to chase up to him. Your day is ruined. You're going to carry that anxiety. You're going to carry that cardiovascular hypervigilance through the course of the day. You're going to be at your first meeting, and you're going to probably be still thinking about how that jerk, quote-unquote, almost hit you. And later on at lunch, you might be someone might say, "Hey, how's your day?" Instead of talking about how the meeting went and how you're trying to help your company's cause, you might quickly again go back to, "I almost got ran off the road." And all of that time, how do we know that that person that almost ran you off the road was doing that because they just got a call from the hospital saying their wife's about to give birth, or that their father's in the hospital and has a few moments to live? And so I ask people to really think that there is a lot of reasons of why somebody chooses to do something that unless you've asked them, you don't know. So why allow such emotional ramifications to occur to you from experiences that you don't know what the other person was thinking? And by, you know, and a lot of this is in the same realm of yoga and meditation. It's trying to tame the angry mind. And to me, that's the platform of my book. That's chapter one. I find that if there's one chapter folks around the world can read and really integrate a little bit of just learning to slow down your automatic thinking and try to undo the negativity and the hostility, you might find yourself feeling a lot better when you engage with your colleagues, your friends, your family. And I really press that issue a lot. I really do believe that's the hallmark of step one of good mental health, to minimize long-term anxiety and depression risk.
Oh, that's really good. As a person who was very angry for a long time, one of the things that motivated me to move past it was to realize that if I got angry with somebody like that, that's one time that person got me. But if I keep the anger inside of me and it's still working inside of me, I'm really allowing that person to get me twice.
Yeah, and they're bullying you. You're
right.
You're allowing that person to bully you.
Right. And so yep. I went, well, hey, I don't want somebody to have that much power in my life.
Yep.
And let me just clarify, you mentioned a CBT therapist, a cognitive mm-hmm. behavioral therapist.
Correct.
For anybody who heard that and went, "What? What's that?" one of the basic things in cognitive behavioral therapy is that emotions arise from our thinking. Correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you're then saying let's change the way we're thinking. And
and I'm sorry to interrupt you, because I think this is a very important point that I want to make to the listeners.
Uh-huh.
Especially those who are parents, is that if, and a mentor once said this to me, and I just, it's so true, you know, our country is still so far, we're like in the middle ages of teaching our young people about emotional intelligence. He would say if we spend just a few minutes like we do teaching our five-year-olds how to tie their shoes and how to ride a bike and how to manage their emotions and not allow your thoughts to get you so angry, that as we get older, those folks 20 years from now, we'd have a much less connection to mental health issues in this country. And I do believe that.
Well, you're now talking my territory. I wrote a series of manuals for parents in the 1990s mm-hmm. to help them teach their children how to work with emotions. And
yep.
three of those I've rewritten and posted on Kindle. They're called the ABCs of Anger and the ABCs
yep.
of Love. So I agree with you. And one of the things that I learned I don't know, a few years back that really impressed me is that if we don't help our children to learn how to deal with their emotions, especially in their early years, mm-hmm. that we human beings continue to just repeat the first 7 years of our lives, emotionally speaking,
mm-hmm. yep.
throughout our lives.
Correct. And yeah. then they usually come to see me between 18 and 22.
All right, so we could also tell people not to help their children, and then you could get more business. How's
I have
that?
Business for life anyway, thank you, though. But yes, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we definitely want people to get the help. I'm only joking about that.
Right, we're joking.
So the other area, another area that I really related when I was reading Reinvent Yourself is this whole area of codependence. You talk about it looking for validation in others instead of yourself. I think that is really key in today's world that we don't
yeah.
do that so much.
Right, and that's especially in New York City where, you know when you walk out the street, there's probably somebody who might be famous or is a CEO or might be a famous musician. And so you're bombarded with this this path in life to become a person like that or to have a person like that tell you that you're good. It's all about that getting that external validation. And a lot of that usually stems, again, from the parenting. And did your parents either, A, never share with you that you were good enough? I have about three active clients in my office right now that are the sons of, two of them are the sons of billionaires. One is the son of a multimillionaire, and they're both in their late 30s in so much psychic pain, haunted, trying to get that validation from their affluent father who never said good job to anything that they've tried to do and always sort of denigrated anything that they put their mind to, saying that, like, you know, that was, hey, good job, good try, but it's never going to be as successful as I was. You should listen to me. You should only do as I tell you. And they're haunted by that. So if you grow up with that type of parenting, you're absolutely going to go look for that type of validation. But on the flip side, I think we're starting to see a lot more unhealthy narcissism in our late teens and early 20s because it's the internet that because we're losing the disconnect from appropriate, healthy, interpersonal interactions in the world,
right.
and we're having more of our interactions online, people are only willing to share and expose themselves to those highlighted, valuable moments that, this goes back to how we started today's session, they don't want to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I made so many mistakes in my early years, even into my 20s, and I would easily share them with people, say, hey, I did this. It went wrong. I know this was a mistake. How do I improve? Kids are not mm-hmm. doing that anymore. They're so worried about how their ego is being defined by others that they're not willing to share the mistakes they're making, so they're not getting mentorship, and they're not able to see outside the box all the ways to navigate and make decisions. And I think we're creating this vicious cycle where they're not worried about making mistakes, and they're continuing to be inundated with the acceptance from others. I saw a young man last night. He graduated from Dartmouth, and he is in so much pain because he is ashamed of his pretty amazing job he has in Manhattan, but because of Facebook, he sees the 1 or 2% of kids that he went to Dartmouth with that already are working for top-tiered politicians or are top of their class at medical school, and he is ignoring the successes he's made, and he's only defining himself as a failure in lieu of what he sees other people post on Facebook day in and day out, even though he doesn't know anything else about those other people's lives. And like I mentioned, just because they are doing those things, maybe they stink at friendships or they stink at having relationships, and that's all they're exposing themselves to. But because that's what we're enamored by, that's all he's focusing on, and it's kind of upsetting to watch.
So you're really talking about our tendency to compare ourselves to others. And someone, a mentor in my life who was very wise, said that no comparison is accurate ever because a true comparison compares everything.
Correct.
And no two people have everything the same, so you can't compare.
Correct. This poor boy, I mean, he's very similar to my upbringing. He has two very blue-collar parents, and right now, even he's in his late 20s, having a lot of anger. It's funny because this is so many similarities. He's going through the phase that I went through in my early 20s when I had the first awareness that there's a lot of folks who are going to have advantages because of their parents' affluence or their networking. And I remember many of weeks that I unfortunately tortured my parents with anger, saying, why didn't you guys have more friends? Why don't you know more famous people or successful people in Manhattan? I wouldn't have to be worked so hard. I'm so behind the eight ball. And that was a process that I had to work through, in the acceptance that I can't go back, I can't change my parents, and whatever successes I'm going to achieve is going to be based on what I can strive for on my own. And the same thing with this poor boy is right now he's angry at his parents because he's comparing himself to his Dartmouth crew that, you know, being an Ivy Leaguer, you're going to have a lot of parents who also went to Dartmouth and are one or two steps ahead of his generation, where he should be so proud of being from blue-collar folks up in Vermont and where it was able to get into an Ivy League school. But he's ignoring that.
Mm-hmm. You made a statement there that you were going to have to strive for something on your own. And I go back to especially helicopter parenting, where we don't teach people that I was yesterday talking with a man who's in his early 50s who does not yet have the notion that it's up to him to create his own life.
Yeah.
And that is a key thing for all of us, that we are, in fact, constantly creating our own lives. And if something's not going right, and this is a major thing that you're talking about too, and reinvent yourself, the major thing we need to do is focus on what do we want to actually create, where do we want to actually go, and then, as you said before, fill in with the tools and get going.
Yes, yes. But just like you said it, that sounds hard. And a lot of people aren't up for that mental challenge of discipline and taking it day by day and breaking it down to the small steps and really acknowledging where their weaknesses are and continuing to build those strengths. I think a lot of folks feel, again, I think the internet is at fault. They think if they can Google it, they'll find the answer that tells them how to do it and bypass all the hard work that's needed to achieve it.
Uh-huh. You know, when my son, I have a son who's sounds like about a year older than you, but when he was in seventh grade, he wasn't doing very well academically. It turned out he was dyslexic, and nobody was picking that up at the time. But I said, how come you're not doing better in school? And he said, well, it's so much work. And I thought about that for about a day, and then I said to him, you know, I think I have some bad news for you. The world, I believe, is about work. You know, even if when you grow up you decide you're going to drop out of everything and become a drug addict, you're still going to have to work to find a place to sleep. You're going to have to work to get the money to satisfy your drug cravings, and you're going to have to work to stay out of the way of any bad guys that come into your life.
Correct. So, that's a great analogy.
Yeah. So there's no way you're going to get out of working. The thing that you have the capacity to do is to decide where you want your work to take you.
Yeah.
And that's a big sort of underlying message, I think, in Reinvent Yourself.
It is. It truly is. I think if you spend 10 minutes reading any chapters in my book, it is going to say, you must do, you need to do. I mean, which is various words in the English language are pretty much saying you need to work and you need to work. Unfortunately, challenging, though, is that I see a lot of clients who unfortunately actually don't need to work because their parents do have those resources to, and I guess it's prolonged helicopter parenting, where I meet folks in their late 20s, early 30s who truly have access to resources financially that don't require working as hard as the other average person. But interestingly enough, that hasn't minimized their risk for anxiety and depression because, A, they are aware of that and they have higher expectations for themselves, and they're more frustrated that maybe they took the easy road a lot of their early years because they didn't have to do well in school or do well in college, and now they're playing big catch-up. Or they came from, because their family didn't have to worry about finances, the parents were aspiring them to be famous actors and musicians. And as we all know, unfortunately, money doesn't buy that. That's an unbelievably challenging career to obtain, regardless of status. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of young people who are very, stuck on needing that type of validation to feel like their life was a success because their parents and them never felt school or education or getting a job like the common man was going to be of utility for them. So they're really in a rock and a hard place.
Yes, and just to add to that, I work with someone, a man who's in his mid-70s, who did come from a very wealthy family, and he did almost get a PhD, but he really has not made his own money in his entire life.
Yeah.
And the big issue for him is, what good has my life been? What has it mattered that I was here? What does it matter that I'm here now? And it's a big struggle. So
yeah,
how much better for us to find out by putting our effort in when we're younger, whether we need money or not, we still can reinvent ourselves and do things in the world that have meaning for us and for other people.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point because, it steps away from the idea that just gaining affluence is the only source of meaning in this life. Obviously there's plenty of people walking around doing wonderful, working at nonprofits, volunteering experience, taking care of animals, taking care of our underserved. Those are extremely wonderful ways to find meaning in life. But I find a lot of people, especially young people, going back to the seeking validation, those fields just don't feel important enough. They don't feel like there's something that you can post on Facebook and people are going to think that you're special or have done something of worth. And so that's becoming a big challenge, where there's a disconnect to what people think the human experience is all about and what they hope it to be.
Well, hopefully things are kind of shake up a little bit. I don't know. We're up to our second break. I'm talking today with Brooklyn-born, respected Williamsburg psychiatrist Dr. Johnny Lopps, who's been an actor and an amateur marathon runner and is now an author. And he's going to tell us the difference between nice people and kind people just ahead, right here on Full Power Living. Difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want, to take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes, or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with psychiatrist Dr. Johnny Lopps, and nobody's taken the opportunity to talk with Dr. Lopps personally. You certainly still can do that at 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. And Dr. Lopps is an author of a new book titled Reinvent Yourself, Essential Tools from a Brooklyn Psychiatrist Who Has Seen It All. I like that title. You know, I really so enjoyed, we'll get right down to this nice and kind business here. I really enjoyed you talking about nice because certainly as a female, I was taught you should be nice, you should be nice. And over the years, I have found that this emphasis on being nice really has the capacity for creating monsters. People who will be nice on the surface and knife you in the back at other times. And so in my work, I've come to appreciate honesty as opposed to niceness. So you talk about kindness.
Right.
Tell us about your differentiation of those two.
Correct. And I would say the honesty would go in the realm of my kindness. Well, but first, the inspiration to this chapter is that I just found over the years that a lot of my patients and clients, that there is this phenomenon about there's an insecurity. We have a little bit of a self-loathing. We want people to like us. And it's almost like another tool. It's almost like it's an inverse manipulation where we can act so ingratiating to others that we can get people to pay attention to us, to like us, and we create this sort of noxious cycle where people will pay attention to us, they'll call us, and because they'll need something from us, and because we never learn to set healthy boundaries or say no because we're afraid of being dejected from others if we do that, we end up creating this characterological trait of being quote-unquote nice that, though it might be effective in the long run, I think it leads to burnout because you're the one that the boss will always come to on the Friday afternoon and say, hey, we need somebody to come in the weekend, and would you do that for us? And you're just so paralyzed to disappoint the boss, you're going to say yes. And even at the more concerning level, if we use that technique as a way to generate a partner, then we're enabling and creating the platform that in our relationships, you're always going to say yes to everything that partner wants you to do. And you can kind of say that's another trajectory towards a type of emotional abuse, because once you set that platform, that's what the other partner is going to expect is going to be the go-to for the rest of the relationship. And at any moment you want something for yourself, they're going to look at you like you have two heads, because that's not the way it works in this relationship. And so I found a lot of people in my practice.
You're describing my early dating life. Go ahead.
I just see a lot of people in my practice, from young people to people even in their late 50s, that are just getting burned out. They just get burned out. They just don't know how to get out of this vicious cycle where they're the nice person, whether it's in the relationship with their friends and at work, and they are starting to realize that they don't have enough time for themselves because they're taking on the burden of the work. So that's the nice people. The kind people are like what you were saying, being honest, that you can look at your boss and say with a straight face, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I do have a family outing this weekend. Hopefully somebody else in the office can do it. If you give me advance notice, I'd be willing to do it maybe next time, but just if you can give me some advance notice. And even though you're disappointing the boss in that moment, you're doing it with empathy. You're acknowledging that you're upsetting that person and you're disappointing them, but you're not doing it where you're not being rude, you're not being disrespectful, you're just looking them in the face, in the eyes, and sharing your inability to do what they're asking. And that's fine. That's setting boundaries and advocating for yourself. And a lot of people out there don't do that, and they get stuck in these situations where they really struggle to get out of, and it takes a lot of work in the therapy.
You know, a few years ago, I worked with a young woman in her 20s who had two roommates, and she so didn't understand that she could set boundaries that her life was falling apart because she didn't feel that it was all right for her to go to bed at night unless it was okay with her roommates. And I mean, really, her life was just falling apart, and so...
Right.
I talked to her about boundaries being a way of loving yourself. And when you have filled yourself up with love, then you have more love to give to other people. And fortunately, she got it. And her life just turned 180 degrees. So I think this is really important what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
And another thing that you talk about is being a victim, which I certainly was for many, many years. And a lot of people, I mean, this sort of ties in with being a victim. When you're trying to be nice and you don't set boundaries, then it's easy for other people to take advantage of you. And once they do, then you think, what's the matter with me? I'm always being picked on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and that's probably the most complicated chapter in my book. I also believe it's the longest chapter in my book, because to take it a step further, I think this is the risk factor that can variably shape your whole life in a negative manner if you allow the victim role to become your identity. A lot of folks who are trying to, maybe they are trying to persevere, maybe they are trying to do better for themselves, but when a situation arises that they are a victim, a lot of people, not that they're waving white towels and they're giving, I don't want to say that they're weak, but for a lot of people, they'll take on that tragedy and incorporate it and give meaning and find meaning in what happened to them and allow that to now define who they are. I can't, Dr. Lapps, I can't become an actor anymore because I had a trauma when I was doing a play 10 years ago, or Dr. Lapps, I can't, you know, and so, you know, they will allow these experiences to now give them validation of why they couldn't persevere in something, and I get it. It makes sense, but to me that's so heartbreaking, because if we just get right back on the path as fast as we can and before that integrates into our skin, into our character, you can move through it much easier and navigate the course that you were originally trying to get onto. And that's why I think the biggest recommendation I give in that chapter is you can't use it. You can't. If people start giving you sympathy and more people start coming around, you know, that's nice that other people are doing that, but you can't allow that to realize, like, ooh, wait a minute, because of this situation that happened to me, a lot of people are giving me more attention, so maybe I'll linger in this a little while because, you know, I have been a little lonely. I know it sounds tempting, but it's completely the wrong strategy to take, and you have to understand that, yes, kind-hearted people in the world might pay more attention to you if something bad happened, but you need to work through that and move away from it as quickly as possible and get right back on the original journey that you had established for yourself.
Many years ago, Dr. Lapps, my daughter was in her late teens, and she was in an unhappy relationship that she kept saying she wanted to get out of. And I would listen to her, and as a good therapist, I'd try to help her as well, until I finally realized that every time I sympathized with her for being in that situation, I actually was feeding her energy and helping her stay in the relationship.
Right.
And so I called her after visiting one day and said, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'll walk away. I'll hang up the phone. I'll listen to anything positive you want to tell me, but I'm not listening to the negative anymore. And she was out of that relationship within 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you were in a way. It's you were like, yeah, and not just enabling, but you were sort of refueling her to go back into it.
Yeah, and we don't realize that. We think we're helping the person and sympathizing with them and helping them through, but really what we give energy to, what we pay attention to, we're feeding it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very, like I said, I'm going to be very humble. That's probably the most difficult chapter in my book and one of the most difficult things for folks to overcome in life.
Well, you did. You were almost literally victimized by a patient you write about, Sarah. She was ready to bash you over the head with a heavy flashlight.
Close to being killed as a psychiatrist, yeah.
Yeah, right. But there are things you learned, and I think a lot of people who are listening may have really bad experiences, and all they will do then is talk about the bad experiences, but mm-hmm. not focus on what there was to learn. So will you share some of the things that you learned from that experience?
Well, yeah, let's you know, take it a step back and educate everyone that this was a young girl who had terminal cystic fibrosis, and well, maybe I should tell the story first and then not do. But the story was, I was on call one night in the hospital, and I got a call at 2 o'clock in the morning that there was an agitated patient. And when you're on call at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're grumpy and you're tired and you want to go to bed because you have to go back to work the next day. And so I went to this unit, hoping to de-escalate the situation and get back on with things with myself because I'm tired. I was thinking about me. And when I got there, it was Sarah. And we've always had a long relationship with Sarah being agitated on the unit. And your defenses go right up. You're angry. You're like, oh, come on, really? I'm not sleeping because of Sarah again? Like, why doesn't she ever get with the program? Mm-hmm. There I was doing the paperwork to transfer her because of she was having some medical issues. And I had noticed quickly that there was this sort of janitor flashlight that looked like it weighed about a good hefty 30 to 40 pounds. And I, in a moment of instinct, I felt something coming from behind me. And I turned around, and there was Sarah about raising this flashlight about to bash the back of my head, and there's no question I would have been brain dead. This 30-pound flashlight on the back of your head, I'm sure I wouldn't have survived. And of course, a very upsetting moment. I was shooken up for some time, but as I got reflected in the moment, and I tried to help do my own therapy to myself and work through the emotions about this experience that I almost could have died. I had to take a moment and say, wait, you know, Sarah, as I gave away, terminal cystic fibrosis. She knows she's going to die from this terrible childhood medical condition that she never asked for, and she was spending a majority of her life left in rotating between psychiatric hospitals and medical hospitals. She'd be in the medical hospitals because of relapse, and then she ended up in the psychiatric hospital because she was aggressive and defiant, refusing to comply with the medical requirements. It was a tortured experience, and this girl is still 14 years old, and her 14-year-old brain is telling her to worry about relationships and dating, and she should be, you know, texting and whatever 14-year-olds do. And here, this unfortunate young girl was stuck in this situation that she never wanted to be. And I think when I started really owning that, I was able to forgive her because I realized that it wasn't about me. She didn't want to kill Dr. Lopes. She was just angry that no adults and no authority figures were allowing her to have a semblance of an adolescent life that she deserved. And that was heartbreaking. And I'm getting a little worked up as I tell the story again. And I think we just need to always walk around that whenever, this goes back to almost chapter one with the automatic thoughts, mm-hmm. that whenever something negative happens to us, if we take a moment to reflect on what's the understanding of the other person, we might be more likely to heal, not become a victim, and move back on with our lives as we were intending to.
And reinvent yourself to go the way that you want to. Unfortunately, it's time for us to stop. I'm really enjoying this conversation with you.
Me too, thank you.
Reinvent Yourself is the name of Dr. Johnny Lopes' book, and it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores. You can find out more about him at Dr. Johnny Lopes, DrJohnnylope, as in Paul, S.com, DrJohnnylopes.com. And on Facebook, you can find him, too, at Facebook.com/DrJohnnylopes, spelled the same way. So, Dr. Lopes, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you and to hear the kindness in you, and to talk with you person to person, and know that someone of your ilk is in a psychiatric office working with people and helping them to live better lives, and also so many more people now can be reached through your book to Reinvent Yourself.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for being with us on Full Power Living today.
Thank you.
All right, next week, listen when I talk with Uma Girish about love, life, and life's losses. And I look forward to having you with us next Thursday. That's July 23rd at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern Time. And I really appreciate you listening to our show. So Mike Cantor has been our producer today. He's affiliated with Fresh Talk Media, working from the San Diego area. Thank you very much, Mike. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.